Greetings. My name is Bob McChesney. Welcome to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 here from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we'll be talking about probably the single most important media policy issue of the year, if not the decade, the question of net neutrality. Joining me will be two of the leading activists working on this issue around the nation for Move On and for Free Press and for the Save the Internet Coalition today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Grassroots mobilization is making a difference in the congressional fight to preserve free speech online. Just last week, it seemed like the House of Representatives was poised to pass some terrible telecommunications legislation that would allow phone and cable companies to discriminate against online content providers depending on a speaker's ability to pay. But a broad and deep coalition banded together to pound Capitol Hill with a call to preserve the principle of network neutrality for the Internet. It began with some 50 diverse organizations. That number has since multiplied eightfold. More than 2,000 bloggers took up the call, and more than 500,000 people have signed on to a petition supporting net neutrality safeguards. And the inventor of the World Wide Web is now on record in favor of a free and open Internet. Meanwhile, lobbying groups fed by the major phone and cable companies are spending nearly $1 million a week running television advertisements in the Washington, D.C. market, which attempt to paint their drive to kill off an open Internet as good for America. And major media companies are already working with phone and cable giants to secure preferential treatment for their content over new fiber optic broadband networks. Last month, CBS and Verizon announced an agreement whereby Verizon will carry CBS television programming over its new fiber optic system. CBS gets money plus, quote, the bandwidth and flexibility to reach customers in innovative ways, end quote. Does this mean that Verizon's fiber optic network will slow down or lock out non-CBS video? Nobody knows. The terms of the deal are private. But the politicians are waking up. At least two bills now circulate in the House that would prohibit data discrimination. They join two pending bills in the Senate that also seek to preserve Internet freedoms. However, both houses also continue to work on comprehensive telecom bills filled with several other poison pills. For example, House legislation would take away local communities' rights to negotiate franchise agreements with cable TV providers, which stands to kill off public access television channels around the country. And in the Senate, telecom reform includes draconian provisions that would require digital TV and radio broadcasters to lock down their content with special encryption that would prohibit people from recording anything. The Senate bill would also prevent communities from establishing their own publicly owned broadband networks unless they built them with a private partner. The House of Representatives could send its comprehensive telecom bill to a floor vote any day now, while the Senate's not expected to act on the issue until sometime in June.
The Federal Communications Commission is finally taking the subject of radio payola seriously. New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has been digging into pay-for-play scandals for the last 2 years. He's already secured tens of millions of dollars in settlement payments against two major record labels, and more are expected. Earlier this year, Spitzer turned his attention to the radio side of the payola equation, suing the 95-station Intercom broadcast chain for taking cash and gifts in exchange for song airplay. Spitzer's also examining the practices of Clear Channel, CBS Radio, and Citadel Broadcasting. Until now, the FCC's been watching the New York proceedings with detachment, but late last month, the agency finally began its own payola probe. For their part, the mega broadcasters attempted to preempt FCC scrutiny by offering to pay paltry settlements of their own. But the proposed payments didn't do justice to the scope of the illegality alleged in modern payola practices.
Yet another dubious journalistic milestone has been passed in the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. More journalists have now died covering Iraq than were killed during all of World War II or the Vietnam War. The Virginia-based Freedom Forum reports that since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, 74 journalists from 20 countries have died covering the conflict. That compares to 69 journalist fatalities in World War II and 63 in Vietnam. The Iraqi Journalists Association, however, puts the death toll since 2003 at 112 and notes that, on average, three news workers were killed every month last year. In somewhat related news, a dubious journalistic practice from Iraq has found its way home. The Department of Homeland Security says it will begin embedding reporters with its personnel when they respond to floods, fires, hurricanes, and other mass emergencies. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff says the embed plan is designed to keep curious reporters from interfering with DHS emergency response efforts, but he pledged it would not be used to censor stories. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 on this Sunday, May 7th, 2006. It's my pleasure to be joining you. I'm recording this program a few days in advance of going on air here in Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And it is a very timely show at that. The topic of today's program is going to be net neutrality, an issue that sounds a bit wonky perhaps, but if you learn about it today and learn about what's going on with it, I think you'll see the singular importance it holds for the future, not only of the internet, but really of the entire communication system in the United States and perhaps even globally. Joining me to discuss this issue are two of the leading activists working on the campaign surrounding net neutrality. I'm joined from New Jersey by Tim Carr, the campaign director for the group Free Press, which I'm connected with. Many of you know I'm the president and co-founder of Free Press. Tim is based in New Jersey, and he is directing Free Press's work in this area and the Save the Internet Coalition. Also on the line with us is Adam Green, the civic communications director for Move On, the well-known activist group. And Adam Green is working heavily on the net neutrality issue with Tim Carr and a host of other organizers at the Save the Internet Coalition. Tim, Adam, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
All right. Well, let's start with you, Tim. And just a lot of our listeners have heard a little bit about net neutrality. Some of them have heard a lot, and some of them haven't heard a word at all. So, Tim, why don't you briefly describe what the term net neutrality means and why it's important?
Well, net neutrality is really the most fundamental principle governing the Internet. It ensures that anyone who goes online can go anywhere that they want, download anything that they want, and without any interference. I mean, the beauty of the Internet is that it's dumb, and that all of the intelligence is not in the works of the Internet, but with the people who reside at the ends, who use the Internet and decide where they go freely. And net neutrality is a principle that has governed the Internet for the last decade or so, and it's because of net neutrality that the Internet has become a revolutionary force for economic innovation, civic participation, and free speech. Without this principle, a lot of the network controllers and network owners, companies like AT&T and Verizon, could interfere with your Internet traffic and basically discriminate in favor of websites that pay them money and block or more likely slow down others that don't pay a price for access. And as we move more and more towards a high-speed Internet world where all of our media, you know, video and telephone calls are online, these large corporations are more and more interested in controlling that traffic and profiting from it at the expense of the public.
Adam Green from Move On, why exactly are these companies interested in doing this exactly? What is so profitable about getting rid of net neutrality? What does that actually mean in the real world? I mean, if we go inside the boardroom of a Comcast or an AT&T, the companies that provide Internet access to almost all Americans in their homes and most businesses, what's their game plan here? Why is this an issue of importance to them to get rid of the notion of net neutrality?
That's a great question, because I'm sure most people are thinking to themselves, who in their right mind would ever want to destroy the free and open Internet as we know it? And the answer is that there's some very self-serving companies who pretty much see this scenario. You know, right now, anybody can go on their computer and have access to the smallest blog just as easily as they have access to the largest corporate website. And they're thinking, hey, if we put a toll booth up and charge the largest corporate website money in order for their website to open quickly on people's computers, why not make a quick buck? Of course, the downside to that is that anybody who cannot compete with the big guys, you know, the little guy with an innovative idea who can't pay to have their website open as quickly and their services open as quickly as a giant corporation gets put in the slow lane. They get left behind. So in a sense, most of us lose. The free and open internet as we know it loses. The big winners are the few internet operators like AT&T who will make a bundle through these self-serving policies. There's one other thing to point out. Let's say you have an iPod right now, which I do, and you're used to downloading music. An internet operator like Comcast, which has its own music service, could legally, if net neutrality is destroyed, slow the opening of iTunes on people's computers and gradually drive more and more traffic to their own, possibly more higher-priced, music download site. So in essence, they can skew the entire marketplace, send people to their own services, and really reap a bundle. But of course, the internet as we know it would be gone.
So if I get this right, Tim and Adam, the real money that comes for the phone companies and cable companies that really are, I think 98% of Americans get their internet access from one of these two types of services. And there's just a handful of companies then. And usually in any community, you've only got two choices. It's a duopoly, if not a monopoly in most places. The way these companies are going to make their money is by giving some websites preferential service that'll come through faster. And then logically, people will tend to go to those. And theoretically, they can also, if they want to, actually ban websites or make them so, if not outright ban them, make the access to them so tedious and so slow as to effectively ban them. Is that an accurate presentation?
No, that is absolutely right. What they're looking for is the ability to control traffic in a way that drives revenue to their own corporations or to companies that pay their fee for access to a very fast lane. So what you have, again, and Adam said this very well, is this sort of small innovators, the type of people who have made the internet such a revolutionary force for innovation, the people who are working out of their garages on a new economic idea, or political groups, much like Move On, that started from a very small list but used the internet to grow because people wanted to take action on these issues. These sorts of innovations would be subject to this discriminatory practice and be pushed to the side. So you have these little guys who would suffer, and as a result, the internet would just be fundamentally changed. So
you're listening to Tim Carr and Adam Green, my guests today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580. We're pre-recording this show a couple days before going on the air today, of course, on the air. It's May 7th. So please don't call in. Sit back, relax. Let us do the talking today. The topic of today's show is net neutrality, the core principle, the policy principle, which has kept the internet open, non-discriminatory toward any person who wanted to put up a website so that all websites are created equal and all users are created equal to the internet. And now that principle is under direct attack by the large internet service providers, the phone companies and the cable companies that desperately want the right to discriminate so that there can be multiple tiers of websites, some that come through very quickly, some that come much slower, and the ones that come through quickly are the ones that pay these companies the most money or that they themselves own. And some people say, well, gee, this doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, what are the really lucrative areas? Adam Green, you mentioned music. What about voice over internet protocol telephony or telephone on the internet? Is this part of the equation?
That's a good question. I would actually let Tim answer that.
The music industry is obviously a very large sector. As you know, as more and more people download music online, that has become a very, very influential force on the market. Now, elsewhere, if you're talking about small businesses that use internet telephone services for both video conferencing, teleconferencing, and VoIP, or the Voice over Internet Protocol, these are very large segments of a new and emerging market. And the telephone companies do not like that a lot of these upstart businesses like Skype and others have created an open source model that allows people to make phone calls via the internet. So yes, they would want to discriminate against those services and steer users towards their own proprietary telephone services. So that's certainly one sector. The other is like the search industry, which has become huge. Companies like Google and about.com and others would be vying for a privileged position on your internet, and they would be paying AT&T or these carriers to be your first search engine in exchange for, you know, this sort of prominent position. So it's no longer really a choice of the consumer. It's the choice of the network controller, the network gatekeeper. And again, this is just a fundamental shift of the understanding of the internet. The intelligence of the internet is with the people who reside at the edges, not with the wires themselves that are supposed to, in a somewhat, you know, indiscriminate fashion, pass packets of information back and forth, allowing the end users to decide what's worth using and what isn't. And when you allow these large corporations like AT&T to instead make a decision that you should be using their service, they're trying to tell you what you should do, the whole nature of the internet, the democratic nature, is being compromised. And right now, you know, there is legislation moving through Congress that will do just that. So we've been very engaged in trying to get the American public to become more aware of this somewhat arcane issue and speak up and say, you know, we cannot compromise the freedoms that we now enjoy online.
Well, we definitely will be talking about what's going on in Congress during this program. But before we get to that point, I mean, as I listen to you talk, Tim Carr and Adam Green, I'm thinking of what Comcast would say, or AT&T, these huge cable companies and telephone companies, and their response would be, hey, this is a free market. We've invested a lot of money in these wires and these lines. We've got a right to maximize our profit. That's the American way. And if someone doesn't like our service, they can go to one of our competitors. We don't have a monopoly, and someone else can try to start a new business and compete with us if they don't like what we're doing. But we've got to represent our shareholders, and we've got to have an incentive to build out our networks. And if we just sit here with these dumb pipes and we don't get a cut of the action, we have no incentive to increase the quality of the broadband speed and network. Adam Green, I suspect you've heard this argument in the last month as you've gone through your wars on behalf of net neutrality. How do you respond?
Yeah, thanks. It's really important to debunk some of these myths that are being put out there. One is this myth that anybody who disagrees with their policies can just switch providers. You know, the head of MoveOn has lived in Brooklyn for a long time, and he's only had one provider of internet service via cable. So if they're doing something really egregious, there are no options for change. And what you'll find is across America, that really is a norm. The norm. There's really very little ability to switch. But there's really even more debunking that has to be done. You know, probably the biggest myth that is being put out by these companies is that it is our side, those who support internet freedom, those who support net neutrality legislation in Congress, who want to somehow dramatically change the internet as most Americans currently know it. They have a kind of a fake coalition front group that's called Hands Off the Internet, which pretty much makes this entire argument. But what they're not telling people is that about 9 months ago, there was a really dramatic FCC ruling, Federal Communications ruling, which essentially scrapped net neutrality and internet freedom as we know it. It essentially said that all the rules that have guided the internet for the last decade, where all this economic innovation happened, where all this online democracy happened, all those rules are down the drain, and they placed a 12-month moratorium on the implementation of this pretty much brave new world on the internet. And what that essentially means is that 3 months from now, the internet as we know it is going to be gone unless we act. And therefore, we're trying to fight to preserve what most Americans consider the internet that they know. But the other side is kind of pretending that they didn't cause this ruling to happen and that things aren't about to vastly change.
Well, Tim Carr, let me ask you this. I mean, isn't this a free market? Isn't this free enterprise? Isn't this, these are companies fighting it out in the marketplace, having to satisfy consumers and giving the people what they want. I mean, and you want to come in and have the government tell these people how to run their business. So is that right?
There are a lot of problems with that argument. One, it really isn't a free market. The marketplace for internet access has been so thoroughly regulated by the largest providers. These are the telephone and cable companies that spend, over the last decade, hundreds of millions of dollars to influence policies in Washington that actually give them advantages that allow them to dominate the marketplace to such an extent that this notion of a free marketplace is a complete myth. What we're really asking for is more competition, which is the essence of a free marketplace, to provide enough competition so that when people are not being properly served by companies like AT&T and Verizon, that they have another choice. At the moment, because of, you know, Adam had mentioned it earlier, because there is such a, in many cases, monopoly or duopoly over markets, again, you have 50% of the American population has only one or no choice of broadband provider at the moment, and 98% of the whole market is controlled either by the leading cable or telephone company. So there really isn't any choice there. So this whole notion of a free market is really bogus. And what we're trying to do is to open up choice to preserve internet freedom so that other providers, some of the smaller organizations that are putting together community internet networks around the country, can come on and offer an alternative when these large telcos decide that indeed they're going to discriminate and they're going to make your internet experience not as free and open as you had hoped.
Yeah, one of the arguments that has come out against the principle of net neutrality that I've seen recently came from one of the figures at the Brookings Institution, the think tank in Washington, sort of moderate politically, neither especially liberal or conservative. And the argument that I saw was that increasingly the internet's going to be the center of the health system, and that people will use the internet and high-speed internet to send data and receive data that will be help save people's lives in remote areas or have access to the finest medical minds. And that if we have net neutrality, it means that every website's going to be at sort of the current slow pace, and that these sort of really high-need web services are going to get slowed down needlessly. And if we get rid of net neutrality, then the health-related sites are going to be able to go super fast. I don't know if you're familiar with that argument, Adam Green, but if you are, is this will net neutrality, in effect, kill a lot of people because they won't get the medical service they need?
Well, no, obviously no. And, you know, I guess the thrust of that argument is this. They're saying we will have these great new capabilities to have high-speed transfer of information in the future, and if we don't put these toll booths up all over the Internet, how will we ever pay for it? They're kind of pretending that they're going broke. But at the end of the day, there are numerous ways that they are making money. These companies charge users a pocketful of money every month to access the Internet. MoveOn, Google, anybody with a website pretty much pays for broadband access on the Internet. And there are numerous streams of revenue for these guys which do not require putting toll booths up all over the Internet. And I really do want to hit the competition point one more time because it's really important for people to understand this. You know, there's a professor at Columbia named Tim Wu, who is one of the architects of the net neutrality principle. And what's interesting is, you know, he was actually a law school professor of mine, and he is a huge free marketeer. He completely believes in freedom of markets, free trade, adamantly so. But he supports net neutrality. And the reason is that monopolies and duopolies hurt the free market. You know, they essentially create an environment where most people cannot compete and most innovation cannot survive because a few people, a few gatekeepers, are abusing their market power to the detriment of the whole. And that's really what's going on here. So all these arguments that are being put up are really pretty flimsy and are really meant to deceive the public when what we're really trying to do is preserve the free and open marketplace.
Let me follow up on that point. Tim Carr, there are a number of companies that are associated with the Internet that have made a lot of money on the Internet and become brand names, household names in the United States and globally. I'm thinking, of course, of eBay, Amazon, Yahoo, Google. To a lesser extent, Microsoft is now connected to the Internet, Intel. Where do companies like this come down on the question of net neutrality? I mean, the companies that truly have been successful thanks to the Internet.
Well, it's a good question, Bob, and because there is a very vast coalition that is forming on behalf of net neutrality, and it does include large corporations like Yahoo and Google and eBay and others who have benefited from a free and open Internet. And they have mobilized their own effort, don'tmesswiththenet.com, which is very much, certainly in principle, aligned with the work that we're doing at SaveTheInternet.com. They are fairly new to the Washington Beltway lobbying scene. They have only recently, some of these companies, set up shop in Washington to try to speak to Capitol Hill and our lawmakers in Congress and at the House and the Senate and the FCC, they're new by comparison to one of the most influential lobbies, which is again the AT&T and the Verizons and the Comcast, who are spending tens of millions. So they are part of a coalition that is seeking to preserve this. This is, they understand what's at stake, and they also understand the principle of a free and open internet, and how, you know, certainly, you know, when you look at Google, it was two Stanford grad students working out of their garage in the mid-90s that have created this multi-billion-dollar corporation that exists today. So really what we're trying to do is preserve the next, you know, Google, the next great innovator on the economic front, but we're also want to preserve this open platform for civic participation and free speech that is truly at risk if you allow AT&T and Verizon to really dictate how the internet is used.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, Adam Green from Move On, the civic communications director there, Tim Carr, the campaign director from Free Press. They are both actively involved with the Save the Internet campaign, with the website at savetheinternet.com. And the raging fight that they are working on and the issue we are discussing today is the issue of net neutrality, the idea of keeping the internet as it has been throughout its history, which is non-discriminatory, meaning anyone who has a website has equal access to the public, and anyone who wants to go on the internet can get to any website, and no one gets any preferential treatment. The network is entirely neutral to everyone. The major companies, the phone companies and cable companies that deliver the internet in monopolistic or duopolistic manner to 98% of the American people, want very much to eliminate net neutrality so they can charge companies a higher price if they want to get the fastest access to the public, and that they can make an enormous revenue stream in sort of shaping the internet to suit their financial interest. It is a fight that is raging right now, as I said, on Capitol Hill, and I want to talk about that. But let's introduce the players a little bit more before we get into what's taking place on the Hill. And I'd like to start with you, Adam Green. Move On is a group I think that many of our listeners are familiar with, but for some of them might not be. Talk a little bit about it, if you would, and then talk a little bit about their interest not only in net neutrality, but really, as I understand it, Move On has taken a very strong interest in media policy issues for at least 3 years now.
And Move On is basically an online network of over 3 million Americans who are highly passionate about their country and their democracy. And our basic job is to empower regular people to make a difference on issues that they care about. And we do tons of mobilizing online, send millions of emails per week to members who signed up. We have online videos and online tools that people can use to contact Congress and even to contact the media when that's appropriate. You know, so obviously internet freedom and kind of the ease of access online is vitally important to us, but I really would like to point out that this really is not a Democratic or Republican issue or a liberal or conservative issue. Tim mentioned the SaveTheInternet.com coalition, which started as 50 groups. Some of those groups not only include Move On, but Gun Owners of America, liberal and progressive and conservative blogs, church groups, groups like Free Press, consumer advocates groups like the Consumer Federation, Consumers Union, group after group, which in many ways have divergent interests in terms of their purpose, but all are united in one thing, that it is vitally important to keep the internet open and free as a force for our democracy. And in terms of media policy issues, you know, a lot of people have criticism of the way that cable has transformed over the years, network television has transformed, even radio. But the internet is really seen as one of the last vibrant forces for democracy in this country. And what we have here is really a defining moment, a historical moment where we either act and stand up for the free and open internet or essentially lose it forever. It's something that, you know, we can tell our kids someday and our grandkids that we were part of a fight to preserve this vital revolutionary force for democracy. So one thing I would point out is that if your listeners actually want to take action on this issue, there's a couple things they can do. First, they can go to the SaveTheInternet.com website or to MoveOn.org, where they can sign petitions. There's a call tool where you can immediately be patched through to your member of Congress. You can write a letter to the editor right online and send it automatically to your member of Congress. There's even links if you're a MySpace person, if you're part of that social network. There's a whole online community that's mobilizing around this. If you're a blogger, we have tools for bloggers. So far, over 1,500 blogs have written about and linked to our SaveTheInternet.com webpage. So what's really happening is kind of a popular uprising among everyone who realizes that the Internet is a force for democracy, and hopefully we're going to win this fight.
Tim Carr, briefly, tell us a little bit about Free Press, what they're up to, what their involvement is with the Save the Internet Coalition.
Sure. I mean, Free Press is a nonpartisan media reform organization that helps amplify the public voice in crucial media policy debates. As you know, Bob, well, the media policy arena over the last 60 years, and more intensely over the last 20 to 30 years, has been dominated by large corporate interests that spend tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to influence policy in Washington. And Free Press came along to push back against that in some respect. We have over a quarter million activists who are very engaged in media issues, issues of access, issues of control and ownership that push back in Washington and organize locally to, again, amplify the public voice in this debate and ensure that the media of our future is more democratic and inclusive and diverse. We were very active in 2003 around the ownership debate at the SEC, mobilizing people in that year. This is, again, an issue that's going to come back to the fore this year as the SEC revisits that issue. But increasingly, we've looked at the Internet as the future of all media, and there are several critical policy issues that are moving through Congress right now that will, again, as Adam mentioned, affect the future of the Internet as we know it. And so we're very engaged on that issue, and we're working with the coalition of dozens of other groups that are from across the political spectrum that range from small knitting groups in Oregon to very large organizations based in Washington, D.C., with national constituencies that all believe that this is a critical issue, and it will impact the way we work online for decades to come.
Tim Carr, if folks want to learn about Free Press, what's the website?
Free Press is at freepress.net, and you can go there. We have a lot of issue briefings, and there are ways that you can get engaged with the issue. You can also sign up for a daily newsletter that is called the Media Reform Daily. It updates you on the latest breaking developments in the media reform movement.
You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about the raging issue of net neutrality with two of the leading organizers working on the issue, Adam Green from Move On, Tim Carr from Free Press. They're both connected with the Save the Internet Coalition, which has a webpage at saveTheInternet.what?
.com.
Oh,
and,
okay.
.org will get you there as well.
.com or .org. Save the Internet. That's the crucial thing, .com. And this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it earlier in the week before the May 7th airing. So please do not call in or try to call in today. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Tim, Adam earlier mentioned how we have 3 months left before the one-year moratorium by the FCC is lifted, and these companies will be eligible then to go against the longstanding policy of net neutrality and begin to discriminate and favor their own services with higher speed and higher quality as websites and discriminate against those that don't pay them off or aren't on their good side. What has been the recent past in Washington? How is this playing out on Capitol Hill? What have we gone through to get to the point we're at today?
Well, right now there is legislation. In fact, last week there was a new bill that was introduced by Representative Markey in the House that would defend net neutrality. There's a piece of legislation that was also introduced last week at the Senate by Representative Snow and Dorgan that would also protect network neutrality.
Snow, so, Republican, Dorgan, a Democrat.
It's a bipartisan bill in the Senate, and we are organizing Americans to get engaged in this policy process as it moves its way through Capitol Hill. And we've to date already sent 500,000 letters to representatives. So representatives on the Hill. I mean, the thinking initially, this is all part of a revision of a 1996 telecommunications law that is being rewritten as current going legislation is called the COPE Act, which is now moving through the House, that basically gives away a lot of the public interest to corporate interests. And we are actively organizing to make sure that this legislation includes network neutrality provisions. That is, you know, provisions that ensure that we have free and open access to the internet. So, in the coming weeks, throughout May and June, this will be a very active going concern. And the SaveTheInternet.com coalition and the work that we do at Free Press and elsewhere is really engaged in making sure that Americans have their say in this process, so that any representative, any elected official who votes against network neutrality cannot do so without suffering some repercussions from a very angry public.
You know, just about 3 or 4 weeks ago here on Media Matters, our guest was Professor Lawrence Lessig from the Stanford Law School, who is a strong supporter of network neutrality. And he spoke on the air about how, you know, just 2 or 3 years ago, he assumed network neutrality was inviolable, that it would never be able to get rid of it. It was sort of built into the DNA of the internet, and that he thought there was only a small possibility we would ever see the end of network neutrality, 10 or 20% at most. A month ago, he thought the chances were now 90% the other way, that the lobbies for the telephone companies and the cable companies had been so successful, winning in the courts a year ago in the famous Brand X case, which you talked about, and then at the FCC and now in Congress, that they would almost certainly, in his view, and this was a month ago, eliminate the possibility of maintaining network neutrality as the guiding principle of the internet, or what you, Tim Carr, have called the First Amendment of the internet. Adam Green, after the last week or two, what's happened in Washington? Do you think the percentage is still at 90%?
Well, if net neutrality were a stock, I think its stock is about to go up. And if AT&T's efforts on this fight were a stock, I think it's dramatically about to go down. And here's why. You know, AT&T and other internet providers have had a very successful multi-million dollar lobbying campaign aimed at Congress, and many members of Congress feared that if they didn't vote the right way, from AT&T's perspective, that they would lose this huge infusion of campaign cash and kind of bear the brunt of other pressure. But something really special happened about a week or so ago. You know, 2 weeks ago, there was a subcommittee vote where net neutrality looked really bad.
This is in the House of Representatives.
House of Representatives, thank you. It was about a 23-8 vote. It looked really lopsided, and those who supported net neutrality were pretty saddened by it. But within the next week, two significant things happened. First, the SaveTheInternet.com coalition formed. Again, groups ranging from Move On to the Gun Owners of America really showed how important this issue was. And secondly, lots and lots of everyday Americans started calling their members of Congress, blogging about this on their websites, and really showing their members that this is not a below-the-radar issue. This is not an issue that people aren't paying attention to. In fact, this is an issue that affects everything that we do, everything that even the most non-political people do. And all of a sudden, the next week, when a larger House committee voted, it was a much more even vote. We still didn't win it yet, but we came a lot closer. And all the momentum is moving in our favor as we go to the House and as we go to the full Senate. You know, within the last week, our online petitions grew from 250,000 signatures to 500,000 signatures. Our stock is rising. Just on Tuesday, the New York Times came out with a very powerful editorial solidly endorsing net neutrality. Our stock is rising. So I think that we're going to win this fight.
Adam, just following up on this point, Adam Green from Move On, how does the popular response to network neutrality compare to popular response to other major Move On outreaches on email? I mean, is it as equal to or greater than the past issues that Move On has worked on?
Well, you know, it really is. It's different. And to some extent, it's bigger. And here's why. We notice a lot of people who aren't typical Move On members, thousands of people who have never signed a Move On petition before or taken an action before, getting involved in this cause. And the reason is that these are people who use Google on a day-to-day basis and don't want their Google to be slowed because of this policy. These are people who have iPods. These are telecommuters who work from home and depend on the free and open internet. People with, you know, who want to have the ability to have the next big idea online and be able to compete in the marketplace of ideas. Regular people who may not even typically read the newspaper or follow politics to the degree that you or I might, but who really care about this issue. So we've seen some real, you know, tapping into communities that don't normally get involved. One other thing I would just add again is MySpace. MySpace, an online community, which primarily is kind of a social network, a lot of organizing around bands and stuff like that. But there was a huge online community now organizing for Save the Internet. So I would just say it's an issue that affects everybody, and therefore interest is larger than usual.
Tim Carr, one of the great developments on the Internet in the past 5 years that's gaining increased attention is the role of blogging. And what a central role it's coming to play in our political culture and our journalism. And you, of course, are a longtime blogger in addition to your work at Free Press. How has the blogging community gotten involved with the net neutrality fight?
Well, it's been amazing. I mean, this is over the last 10 days since we launched the coalition, or actually about 2 weeks now, there have been 2,000 bloggers, more than 2,000 bloggers have linked to this issue. Have linked to the website, have called upon their readers to take action. So it's Congresswoman Eshoo in the House last week or the week before called it a prairie fire, and it really has ignited the blogosphere. But what is unique about this is the blogosphere has often been seen as being highly partisan, as being very divisive, very polarized between the left bloggers and the right bloggers. But we've got bloggers from both sides of the aisle. We've got Instapundits, Glenn Reynolds, center-right blogger, supporting our position, along with MyDD and Daily Coast, which are bloggers from the left. They all are on the same page, and this is a unique scenario. In fact, it may be the first time in the history of the blogosphere, such as it is, that Congress is actually moved in one direction on this issue by the ferocity with which people are blogging about this.
You know, I understand why the phone companies and the cable companies desperately want to get rid of net neutrality, what their self-interest is in this. Who else is on their side? I mean, when they look around the barricades, except for people they're paying off, who else is next to them making the fight to get rid of net neutrality?
I'm not sure anybody else is on their side. I mean, basically, those who are being paid off and those who are willing to sacrifice the entire Internet for their own self-serving needs are the only people who would rationally support net neutrality. Everybody else who's paying attention to this is pretty much aligning on our side.
Well, are there any editorials besides, you've mentioned the one the New York Times published earlier this week on Tuesday, strongly in favor of net neutrality. Have other newspapers come out against the notion of net neutrality?
There's been a smattering of editorials that have come out against network neutrality. The Washington Post, surprisingly, has been very disappointing on this issue. They had an editorial early in April, and again, the WashingtonPost.com, their online presence, published an editorial that basically repeated a lot of the AT&T, Verizon talking points. I mean, in addition to them, there are several what are called AstroTurf organizations. These are groups that present themselves as a bona fide grassroots populist effort, but which are actually funded by AT&T and Verizon in order to write editorials, to do research, to comment in the media in favor of AT&T's position on this. And it's an inherently deceptive practice, but something that has been successful at least in getting these talking points from the cable and telephone companies into mainstream media, and even in some cases getting op-eds printed in fairly mainstream newspapers.
And I would add one thing that,
okay,
you know, the editorials that would come out against net neutrality, as Tim said, are those that have pretty much been fed the AT&T talking points, and those who are really not aware of the current landscape where in 3 months all the rules of the Internet will change unless we act now. And unfortunately, you know, one of the main spinmeisters on the AT&T side is a guy who, for a long time, was a hero of mine, Mike McCurry, former Clinton press secretary, who really has, to some degree, sold out on this issue, has become the mouthpiece of AT&T and these large telecom companies, and knowingly is peddling things that that are not true. Over and over again, he puts facts out there, tries to make it seem like we're the ones that want to change the Internet, when he knows that his own clients are the ones who already appeal the rules, change the rules, and have everything to gain by changing the rules. And even when we've written him emails, even when we've had interactions with him over blogs and pointed out why his arguments are wrong, he continually advances these fake arguments. So for me, personally, it's kind of sad to see someone who, for a long time, was a hero of many who are now fighting for net neutrality, kind of selling out. And unfortunately, that's what some other groups are doing too.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guests today, Adam Green from Move On, who you just heard, the Civic Communications Director there, and Tim Carr, the Campaign Director from Free Press. They're both actively involved in Save the Internet Coalition, SaveTheInternet.com, leading the fight to maintain the principle of network neutrality, the principle the Internet has been based on since its inception, that is now under severe attack and will not survive beyond the summer unless Congress takes action to protect it. They are leading the fight to do that. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not call in today. Sit back and relax and enjoy the remaining 12 or 13 minutes or so of the show. We'll be back live with you next week with the novelist and author and writer Walter Mosley. Then 2 weeks from today, our guest will be John Nichols for a special two-hour show on the political climate of the United States and the world in the middle of 2006 and going forward. But we're here today right now to talk about net neutrality with Tim Carr, Adam Green. And Tim Carr, let's get a map now, if we can, of where things go. Net neutrality got shot down at a subcommittee and committee level in the House. There still has not been a full vote in the House, and the matter still is yet to be taken up in the Senate. How do you anticipate, roughly, this will unfold in the next few months?
Well, I mean, it could be as early as this coming week that we will have a vote in the House on the COPE Act, which is a bill that has been championed by Joe Barton, of the representative from Texas, that doesn't have network neutrality protection in it. There's another bill that Representative Markey of Massachusetts has forwarded to be voted on by the House as well. That could happen as early as this week. There's activity in the Senate along similar legislation, although the piece that in the Senate by, again, Senator Snow and Dorgan has bipartisan support. So as this process unfolds in Washington, we as a coalition will be doing everything within our power to make sure that the American public knows about this and gets in touch with their representatives. So it really depends on the public. It depends on the amount of popular support there is for network neutrality. And as we've seen in the past, and I mean, in 2005, we had a million Americans send a petition to Congress when it was weighing whether or not to cut funding for public broadcasting, and the vote on that on the Hill reversed itself. And we are, you know, we're approaching a million signatures on this petition. If we can push forward in that way and show broad-based popular support for network neutrality, we could change the minds of Congress. And at the moment, you know, if you were to take a tally of our representatives from a week ago, from 2 weeks ago, you know, net neutrality would not be winning this issue. But the momentum has shifted in our direction. It's just a question of how much public support we can rally and how vociferously the public can stand up in defense of their Internet freedoms.
Which they can do right now by checking out SaveTheInternet.com or
Move On.org.
Yeah, well, hopefully our listeners have got that message by now. SaveTheInternet.com is the place to go to learn about this issue, get more background, get exposed to all the arguments pro and con, all the background information necessary, and then how to get involved. And I've been to that website. It has an extraordinary resource, a map where you can actually click on the relevant members of Congress to learn how they voted and how to get in touch with them, so you can learn how your own member's done. If your member is a relevant committee member, and get in touch with your member and let them know what you think. And three of the members of the committee in the House are from the state of Illinois. So our listeners should get tuned into that at SaveTheInternet.com. Adam Green, you know, I understand why these big companies like Comcast and AT&T want to skew the Internet so that the best service goes to the people who pay them off or the companies that they've got a stake in. So if you want to use telephone service over the Internet, or if you want to download videos or music over the Internet, or even purchase stuff or do a search, you know, they get a cut of the action. That makes sense to me. There's a more apocalyptic vision here. That these companies also will have the power, basically, if they want to purge dissident ideas that they disagree with, which are going to, since these are enormous corporations, ideas they aren't as keen on corporate power in our society, ideas that might be more liberal or left-wing or progressive or whatever the viewpoints. They'll have this power now if net neutrality is abolished. Do you think that's a realistic fear, that they would actually exercise some sort of censorship over dissident viewpoints? Is that something we should be concerned about?
a legitimate fear. And this is not idle speculation. It's already happened in places where net neutrality does not exist. A company called TELUS, which is kind of the AT&T of Canada, was recently in a labor dispute with their workers. And there was a website which was sympathetic to the workers making their arguments. And what TELUS essentially did was, for anybody who accessed the Internet through their lines, they blocked the website of their workers. That is outright censorship. Recently, we saw another example here in the United States of, you know, one of the Internet gatekeepers abusing their role. Free Press and Move On and other bipartisan groups have worked on a separate issue on something called the DearAOL.com Coalition, where essentially we're opposing AOL's proposed email tax. And, you know, they want to charge some senders for high priority and leave everybody else behind. And what they did was blocked our emails so that anybody who forwarded around our petition or forwarded around our website address just got a bounce back that said there's a permanent failure, the person you're sending to doesn't exist anymore, which was wrong. And eventually they fixed it after we embarrassed them publicly. But to think that gatekeepers will abuse their role to serve their own interests is completely a legitimate fear.
And you should note that the history has been for companies like AT&T and Verizon is that they've come out and said publicly, trust us, we'll never discriminate, we'll never block content. But if you look at the history of the way that they work on legislation is that they come in and they make promises. They make promises to build out infrastructure so that underprivileged communities can get access to the Internet. And they've done this in New Jersey. They've done it in Texas. They've done it in Indiana. They come forward and they make these promises to actually deliver services. And then the local legislators pass favorable legislation, and then those services are never delivered. It's happened time and time again. It's been very well documented that these corporations cannot be trusted on their promises, and therefore we need to put in place simple rules that will keep them honest.
And for those who are interested in more, there's a part of our website called The Threat is Real, and it has links to all these stories.
Thank you very much, Adam and Tim, for those insights. Now, let's just assume the worst-case scenario. Let's assume Congress does not pass anything on net neutrality. Let's assume that Lessig's nightmare of a month ago, the 90% probability, then comes to pass. AT&T, Comcast, these enormous companies can begin to discriminate. They can favor the websites that they own a piece of or that pay them off the most money. They can even get rid of websites or make them virtually impossible to get access to of groups they don't like or that won't pay them off or that politically are attacking them and their prerogatives in society. If that comes to pass, what do you think our Internet looks like 10 years down the road? Say 5 years down the road. 10 years is a long time in the digital era. 5 years down the road compared to what it looks like now. I mean, what is the real implications of this fight? Tim, why don't you start?
Well, I mean, as the Internet becomes increasingly commodified and as it falls increasingly under the control of these large corporations, you'll see the free and open Internet, the diversity of voices that we now enjoy, become more and more like a cable industry model where you have very large carriers that control access in communities across the country. And not only do they control access to cable television, but they actually control access to programming. They have a menu of options that you can choose from that very often does not have the sort of diverse views and perspectives that we now find on the Internet. So this final refuge for truly free and open media will become more and more like commercial models of the past. I mean, we had the same thing happen with our public airwaves when they were increasingly controlled through very aggressive regulation by these corporations that now squat on our airwaves. They've done the same with cable access. There's a mass consolidation of cable ownership under a very small handful of companies like Comcast and Time Warner. The same model would be very true of the Internet. When you have the duopoly that controls access, also controlling content. Content for new media will increasingly look like content in old media, in television and cable.
You know, but Adam Green, I always, you know, over the last 10 years, every time there's a threat that's put out that the internet's going to be closed down, then it seems like they say, but you don't have to worry because some genius kid is in a garage right now tinkering, coming up with a way to get around whatever they're cooking up because this is such a revolutionary technology. Is there a technological solution to get us around this bottleneck of the duopoly if we lose the net neutrality? Can some genius kid in, you know, a garage in Oregon somewhere cook up something that can magically return us to net neutrality?
I would assume the answer to that is no. I mean, the prerequisite to the little guy being able to have an idea thrive is that the little guy can have their idea put out there and judged and seized upon if people like it. And what we're really talking about here is a huge barrier to entry for a little guy. And, you know, when you ask about what will the internet look like down the road, I guess to put it simply, there are kind of three states that the internet could potentially be in. There's a very good state, which I would argue we're kind of in right now. There's a so-so kind of bad state, which is if you know, the Congress does nothing and the rules that are about to kick in 3 months actually do kick in. And then there's the very, very bad state, which is what AT&T and other companies are advocating for, which is to actually lock into the law zero net neutrality, so that somebody down the road will have to re-explain this issue to the public and somehow muster the political courage on behalf of all of Congress and the President to proactively change the law. You know, if Congress does nothing, which was your question before, we kind of default into this so-so state where the big companies are at least somewhat checkmated from taking as drastic action as they otherwise might, because they realize that the second that they start putting toll booths around the internet, the public will revolt. But what they're really trying to do is abuse these next 3 months where the public has no idea what's happening unless they're really paying attention to this issue. And when I say what's happening, I mean what's happening in 3 months. They have no idea that the rules are going to change. They want to cement their advantages into the law right now so that it's too late to change down the road and the little guy can't break into the marketplace.
That's Tim Carr, we've only got about a minute left, Tim, and I do want to ask one fundamental question. The big companies claim they need to get rid of net neutrality so they can have the profits to build out the system to improve the quality of the system. Is this a fair claim?
Well, it's not a fair claim because they have made this, I mean, they have made this claim time and time again. It's important to note that the United States has fallen from third place to 16th place in internet penetration, broadband internet penetration across its population. So they have received all sorts of privileges and subsidies and legislative grants from Congress and from state level state houses, and have actually never actually fulfilled on those promises. So the notion that they need the freedom to bring everybody online and create a free market with full competition is completely bogus, and you can prove that only by looking at their history and their practices over the last 10 years.
Tim Carr from Free Press, Adam Green from Move On, both of you involved with the SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. I want to thank you very much for joining us today here on Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Guys, good luck with your work. Thank you very much. Stay active. And we'll be back 1 week from today with Walter Mosley. Thank you all very much. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for his excellent work arranging this show. Bye-bye.